Welcome, everyone, to a new season of Westminster Seminars. It's a great pleasure to welcome back Dr. Derek Woodard Layman, who will guide us through living faith, everyday ethics for ordinary Christians. Let's give him a warm welcome.
Thanks, Sarah. Good morning, and thank you for having me back. I think this is my third Westminster seminar, so I am a frequent flyer. When I accepted this invitation months ago, Sarah neglected to tell me that this would be opening day of the new season, so a little bit more pressure to put in a good performance that this is our first time back. Sarah also asked me to open our time this morning in prayer. And I will simply pray the prayer that I've prayed with my two sons since they were wee little lads going to preschool, and I prayed starting last week when they are now both in high school. Pray with me. God, give us open minds to learn, open hearts to love, and open hands to share. Amen. Our topic, as Sarah said, is living faith, everyday ethics for ordinary Christians for these seminars. And this morning we'll be taking up the topic relationship and requirement before God and neighbor. This is our introduction. Let's jump right into it. What is ethics? What is it that you came this morning to hear about, to learn about, to think about, to talk about? What is ethics? Not rhetorical. When you turned up, what did you think we would be doing this morning? What is ethics?
Values.
Good. Values and integrity. The handsome gentleman in the back by the computer. Yeah, getting belief and behavior in sync with each other. What else? Guidelines. Moral compass. Sure, all of these things. Belief and behavior, guidelines and rules, morality and integrity. If that's ethics, what makes ethics Christian? What's the difference when we add that substantive adjective, Christian? What is Christian ethics?
It's Christian, it's supporting messages of the Bible.
Okay, so supporting or embodying the messages of Scripture. What else? Thanks, Ted, for playing Phil Donahue. Going. I think most of us are old enough to remember that talk show.
Well, if we're thinking about aligning beliefs with actions, when we say it's Christian ethics, it's aligning our actions with our Christian beliefs, with our faith beliefs specifically.
Yeah. Perfect. Christian ethics is all those things we said about ordinary ethics, but now put in the framework of faith and discipleship. This means that Christians in different places, in different times, in different traditions, and different congregations, and yes, even in different pews in the same congregation, may have a different sense of what the beliefs of Christian faith are and how they align with our behavior. That's just how it goes. Now, for our purposes in this seminar, we'll define ethics and Christian ethics like this. Ethics is nothing more and nothing less than the description and evaluation of human action. Christian ethics, then, is the description and evaluation of human action based on some set of Christian beliefs and commitments. And again, we can talk about Christian ethics generally. There are, in fact, things that most Christians in most times and places hold in common. But we always have to keep in mind that Christian ethics will always be particular. It will reflect the beliefs and commitments of some set of Christians. It will reflect some particular interpretation of Scripture, some set of theological beliefs. So if ethics is the description and evaluation of human action, and Christian ethics describes and evaluates based on the commitments of our Christian faith, how do we describe and evaluate action? Well, the most fundamental description we can give to any action is to identify its ends and means. When we talk about ends and means, we're talking about what it is we're trying to do. The ends of an action are what the agent, the person doing the thing, is trying to get or trying to get away from. The means of an action are simply the how. How are we trying to get or get away from what it is that we're trying to get or get away from? Taken together, the ends and means of an action give us our most basic description. This allows us to make a preliminary and a provisional evaluation of that action, namely its basic meaning. We start with what was done or might be done if we're thinking prospectively. We ask how it was done or would be done. And this usually, but not always, gives us the why. Why was this action undertaken, or why would we undertake this action? This puts us in a position to then say whether that action was right or wrong, whether it would be good or evil. That's ethics lesson number one. As I said a moment ago, this is my third Westminster seminar. Some of us know each other a little bit. You perhaps recognize my little red Kia parked in the lot over the road there. Now, suppose on next Sunday you were driving up Washington Road, you noticed me in my little red car in front of you, and you saw me pull to the curb and dash inside the Orbis Cafe. What would you imagine I was doing? Number one answer on the board. I'm getting a coffee. Now, why would I want a coffee?
Caffeine.
Okay, it's Sunday morning. It's early, not super early, but maybe I had a late night. I don't know, perhaps I had a 16-year-old who doesn't yet have a driver's license who needed me to pick them up from their friend's place rather late in the evening. So I want some caffeine in order that I can be awake and alert. Now, why do I want to be awake and alert?
To give a good show.
Number one answer on the board, to give a good seminar. Why do I want to give a good seminar?
Because you're the opening act.
Because what?
You are the opening.
Because I'm the opening act. It's opening day. Yeah, I want to do a good job. You've invited me. You've invited me back now 3 times. I want to do a good job. And imagine if you can for a moment that I'm a decent person and a sincere Christian. I also want to love God and serve neighbor. My vocation is theological education. So it's not just I want to do a good job or do a good thing. I want to fulfill what I believe it is that God has called me to do, and in so doing, to love God and serve you, my neighbors. Now let's do this again, but this time imagine that I have an evil twin. Eric. He too is a professor. We're identical twins. We dress similarly. We cut our hair and our beard similarly. We sound alike, so much so that it takes people months and indeed years to learn how to tell us apart. Suppose Eric and I are both teaching seminars. He's at some other congregation out here in the South Hills. And we both start out going into the cafe to get a coffee because we want to be awake, to give a good seminar, to do a good job. But where I want to do this all in service of God and love of neighbor, evil Eric, my no good twin, wants this because he's trying to be famous. He wants to be rich and famous. Notice what is and is not different about me and my no good evil twin, Eric. Externally, as a matter of your observation, there is almost nothing to distinguish us. We look the same and we look to be doing the same thing. However, we have very different intentions and motivations for doing this. Indeed, they're diametrically opposed. I want to love and serve God. He wants to be famous and rich. How should we regard my evil, no good scoundrel brother, Eric? Well, we might think a lot of things. First, we probably think he has misjudged the relationship between his ends, fame and fortune, and the means, being a theology professor. There's not a lot of fame in theology, and even if you are famous, you don't make a whole lot of money. So he probably should have picked a different profession. But we also probably think him, again, a scoundrel. He's treating his students rather shabbily. They're a means to his end. But notice importantly what his bad intentions and ill motives can and cannot do. Assuming he actually is a good teacher, that he presents interesting content in a compelling fashion, his students will learn from him. They can get a good education. And as long as he doesn't say the quiet part out loud, as long as he doesn't let stray an email or a text that gives the game away, his students will think him a good teacher because they really did learn despite his bad intentions. Let's look again at how we've described the ends and means of this action. At the outset, we said the ends of our action are what we want to get and or what we want to get away from. This example illustrates well how most of our actions have both. There are things we're trying to get. At one and the same time, there are things we're trying to get away from. We can plot that using red and green. I want to get a coffee because I want to get awake and alert and get away from being drowsy and dull. I want to get in a position to give a good seminar and get away from circumstances in which I might be boring. I want to do a good job and get away from doing a bad job. And again, ultimately, I want to do this because I want to get into the heart of my vocation of love and service and get out of a position where I'm being unloving or unfaithful. Notice also that each thing that I want or don't want as an end is in turn a means to something else. Coffee is a means to all of these things. It's a means to getting caffeine, which is a means to being alert and awake, doing a good seminar this week, to do a good job as a whole, to fulfill my vocation. But notice crucially that that highest end of love and service is not instrumental. It's for its own sake. I don't love God and serve neighbor in order to be awake or in order to do a good job. Does that make sense so far, how we've laid out ends and means and how sometimes one thing that is an end here is in turn a means in another way? Questions or confusions? Seeing some nods, I guess that means we're on the same page. Okay, let's move from this particular example to some more generalizations about human action and ethics. We find these conclusions attested and analyzed in philosophers and theologians from antiquity to the present. People like Aristotle, Augustine, and Aquinas, more recent figures like Elizabeth Anscombe, who we'll meet next week, and Candace Vogler. All of these figures tell us that the most common characterization we can give to the ends of any human action is goodness. In the very first lines of the very first book, on the very first page of his Ethics, Aristotle tells us that every craft, that is, things people do, likewise, every line of inquiry, things that people think, and every action and decision seems to seek some good. That's why people were right to say that the good is that which everything seeks. However, Aristotle tells us, since there are many actions, crafts, and sciences, and it turns out to be, and the ends turn out to be many as well, the lower ends are sought for the sake of the higher. There's a lot packed into those first three paragraphs. Aristotle tells us, every action seeks some good. That's why the good is that which everything seeks. But the kinds of goods that human beings seek are diverse. They are many. Therefore, the lower goods that we seek as ends are sought for the sake of the higher. As we saw in the coffee example, I sought coffee and caffeine for the sake of teaching well, for the sake of fulfilling my vocation. Thomas Aquinas, the medieval monk, picks up Aristotle's philosophical observations and deploys them for his own theological purposes. Aquinas, as you might know, is one of the greatest theologians in the Roman Catholic tradition. His Summary of Theology is still the standard textbook for Roman Catholic theology these many centuries later. In part two of volume one of his Summary of Theology, in question 94, article 2, He lays things out very mathematically by number and subnumber. He reflects on the form and content of what we call natural law. In this sense, natural law is anthropological, philosophical, and theological. It is the analog of the material laws of the physical sciences. Just as what goes up must come down, this way of thinking about human life says that there are certain things that human beings do naturally, as a matter of course. Although in this sense, the law-like behavior of human action and interaction are more tendencies and trajectories than mathematical certainties. Thomas begins by asking whether or not the natural law is one thing or many things. He says first that there are several precepts or principles of natural law. He identifies a primary precept that is unified, and then four secondary precepts on that basis. The primary precept or first principle of natural law is that every agent acts for an end under the aspect of the good. Hence, the first precept of the natural law is that good is to be done and pursued, and evil is to be avoided. On that basis, Thomas identifies four secondary principles of natural law. The first is self-preservation. He says, as organisms, as creatures, as animals, human beings seek to preserve our own lives. We do the kinds of things that keep us alive. In the face of a threat, we either fight or flight. Second, not as a matter of individual human persons, but as the species as a whole, we tend to propagate. We procreate and have babies. Not each and every one of us, but on the whole, enough of us to keep the human race going. On the basis of those two precepts, Thomas thinks this drives us towards mutual association, society. Minimally, the procreative partnership, but more importantly, people groups. First small local ones, now big national and multinational ones. Think back across the natural history of the human species. If you're all alone on the plains as a Neanderthal, you are prone to be prey for predators. If you have a clan, a tribe, a people group, you're better able to protect yourself and preserve your life. Likewise, it's pretty hard to bring down a woolly mammoth all by oneself. But if you have a hunting party, you have a chance of killing your food. And unlike other mammals, our human offspring are terribly vulnerable for a terribly long time. If it's just you and your baby, or you and your partner and your baby, it's going to be hard to keep your young alive. But again, if you have a tribe, a clan, a community, you can together provide protection and provision for the next generation. Last but not least, Thomas thinks we need to seek truth and knowledge. Minimally, the truth and knowledge that allows us to navigate the world. You have to know that tigers are to be run from, mammoths are to be hunted, and that that little red berry there will make you sick, but that little red berry there will feed you. And Thomas thinks that ultimately our quest for practical knowledge and understanding leads us to ask big questions. Where did this all come from? What is this all for? So he thinks there's some seed of seeking knowledge of God. Excuse me. Now, as you likely anticipate, the big question and the big issue here is, in what sense do Thomas and Aristotle say everything seems to seek the good? Candace Vogler is a Roman Catholic philosopher at the University of Chicago and offers us some assistance in clarifying what we mean by saying all action seeks the good. First, we need to understand what we're not saying. Good here is not the moral sense, it's rather a practical sense. That means that good is not synonymous with right, but is rather synonymous with desirable. Thomas and Aristotle know full well that many human actions are wicked. So when they say all action seeks the good, they're not saying all actions are morally correct morally right. Rather, we're saying all actions seek after something the agent finds desirable. Positively, what we want to get, negatively, what we want to get away from. Two more caveats about this sense of goodness framed as practical desirability. Notice and note well that Aristotle and Aquinas both use the word of appearance and perception. Seems to seek some good, appears to chase some good. This means that our perceptions can be mistaken, misguided, and even malicious. Think back, if you can, to your childhood. Maybe there was something that you wanted more than anything else in the world. You begged your mom and dad, your aunties and uncles to give it to you for your birthday, for Christmas, for Arbor Day, for any occasion you could think of. And maybe you got it. It was under the tree at Christmas. Or maybe you had to get a job and save up your own money and buy it yourself. But when you finally got that thing, your heart's desire, it wasn't all it was cracked up to be. It wasn't quite as good as you thought it was. That would be an instance of our perception of goodness, of desirability being misguided. I thought it was a 10 out of 10. It was really a 7. Or maybe the thing broke after 3 days and it was a complete letdown. I thought it was a 10, it was a 0. That would be mistaken. As for malicious perception, think about the addict. The addict wants nothing more than their next fix, even though they know it's killing them. Their perception of the good isn't just a little off or wrong. In fact, it's 100% the other way around. The thing that they think is good is actually bad. Notice what this means for our description and evaluation of action. It can be mistaken. We can be practically correctly judge that this thing is right, or is good rather, desirable, but then do something wrong in terms of the means we employ to get it. We can be mistaken on both counts. We can be wrong about what is good, and we can do something wrong to get it. Again, think of the addict. Heroin is not good, it's bad. Stealing to get it is wrong. Now, Bogler goes on to tell us that there are three broad ways in which something can be good in the sense of desirable. First, something can be useful. It's instrumental, a means to an end. In our little example a moment ago, coffee was good because it gave me caffeine, which made me awake and alert, and so forth. Second, something can be good because it's fitting. It's not useful. It doesn't give me a way to get from here to there or to get this for that. Nevertheless, it's expressive of something important about my identity, whether that's my personal identity or my identity as part of a group. Think of Christian practices of prayer. Suppose I pray every day, but I never have any experience of God's presence. I don't feel anything. And suppose I pray and pray for this and that and the other thing, and I never get the thing I ask for. Prayer doesn't work for me. So it's not useful. It's not instrumentally good. It would still be good for me to pray, and I should continue to pray because it's fitting for a Christian to pray. It's expressive of something about me and my faith community. Last but not least, something can be pleasurable. It can be enjoyable just for the sake of itself. Suppose next week I'm not out on Saturday night picking up my kid after midnight, but I get to bed early, I sleep 10 hours, I wake up before my alarm with a spring in my step and a sparkle in my eye, I am ready to go. I still might want a coffee next Sunday morning, not because I need the caffeine, but because walking through the door of the cafe just smells so great. That first sip just hits so right. That warm cup in my hand on a cool fall morning just makes me smile. So in that sense, coffee isn't useful, but it's pleasurable. I want it just for its own sake. Let's try another example. What is this person doing? Running, jogging, exercising, training? Why are they running? Yep, she's listening, maybe a podcast, maybe some pump-up music that just, you know, gets her going.
Just for health.
For health and fitness. Why else might she run?
Because it gives the appearance that she's a fit and good and righteous person who takes good care of her body.
Okay, so there may be an actual material benefit of health and fitness, but there also might be some sort of social signaling about conforming to norms of beauty and fitness. Why else might someone be running? Enjoyment. She might be one of those weirdos who just loves to run. It's not me, maybe it's you. You know, that they just get out there on the street, the track, in this case, the promenade in Brooklyn. The stress and strain of the day fades away. All that you have is whatever you're listening to, the heartbeat in your chest, your lungs, and the pat, pat, pat of your footfall. And that's just blissful. I know these people, I do not understand them. We could get imaginative and somewhat humorous and think that maybe just out of the frame, we can't see it, there's a tiger who's escaped from the zoo, so she's running for her life. Or maybe there's a mugger who wants to steal her Fitbit, her heart rate monitor, her headphones, and her smartphone. Or flip it around, maybe there's someone lying on the ground that she's just mugged and she's fleeing the scene of the crime. Maybe she's a competitive athlete. This isn't just a jog or a run, this is training. Building stamina, capacity, mental toughness, pace, so that some future date she can win a track meet, maybe even at the Olympics. Notice also, it can be all of these things at the same time. She can be running for pleasure at the same time she's running for fitness. Those are not mutually exclusive. She might enjoy running even as she enjoys stealing, and she's fleeing the scene, the crime. Notice also that in this instance, like so many instances, running is fitting. In fact, she can't be a runner if she doesn't run. The identity is caught up in the action. Otherwise, she's just got expensive shoes and fancy clothes sitting in a closet. She's a collector of high-end gear. But she's not a runner until she laces them up, goes out the door, and puts in the miles. And again, notice that the exact same identical action, the same physical motion, can be all of these things, or one of them, depending on her motivations. So let's briefly review ethics lesson one. Ethics is description and evaluation of human action. We start by identifying ends and means, what the person wants to get or get away from. She wants to get fit and healthy. She wants to get away from being unhealthy. The means are simply how we do that. In this case, she's going for a run. Ends are specified in terms of goodness. An end can be useful, a means to an end. Go for a run to get fit. Go for a run to get over the stress of the day. Running is one of those activities that we said a moment ago is fitting. You can't be the thing without doing the thing. And last but not least, it can be pleasurable. It just feels good. I enjoy running. That's ethics lesson one, description. Let's move on to lesson two, evaluation. Now, when it comes to evaluation, we need to introduce a wee bit of moral theory some specialized concepts and technical terms. But even as we do, we must not overestimate or misunderstand what theory can do for us. Theories explain how things work and why they work that way. Oftentimes they can predict or at least anticipate what's going to happen ahead of time. And in this, theories are powerful. Even so, theories are limited. They're not omnipotent, they're not imperfect, or they're not, they are imperfect, and they are incomplete. They offer us no guarantees. They simply offer us tools and techniques for the work of ethics. We might think of ethical theories, moral theories, as spotlights that illuminate certain features of action, that highlight certain aspects of human interaction that we want to pay attention to, and that they focus our attention here rather than there. Sticking with that metaphor of the spotlights, no single theory can illuminate everything all at once, all by itself. Light creates shadow. It hides some things even as it reveals other. So for this reason, we want to employ theories together, not one to the exclusion of the other. Sometimes we might want to employ them sequentially. Think of a solo in the middle of a musical, all the lights go out except for the center spot. In others, we'll employ them all at the same time, as we see here on the screen, creating multiple light spots of attention. Now, if you consult any textbook of moral philosophy or moral theology, you'll likely come across three moral theories, three big families of theory. We can take these one at a time. Absolutism, sometimes called deontological ethics, focuses our attention on commitments, both our personal values and ideals. We talked about integrity. If I have an ideal and I have a commitment, I need to live up to it. They also focus us on our obligations and duties. So yes, absolutism and commitment is somewhat self-referential. What am I signed up for? You know, if I'm a Christian, I have these sets of commitments. If I'm not, I don't. But it also reminds us that we're not just moral free agents. We're in communities and societies. We owe things to one another. We have obligations. We have duties. There are rules. Absolutism focuses us on those sorts of things. And like our parents when we were young, and like ourselves when we were parents or grandparents, absolutism reminds us that sometimes the right thing to do is still the right thing to do, even if we lose out, fall short, or get left behind. The fact that doing the right thing doesn't work doesn't mean that it's not the right thing to do, and doesn't mean you get to do something else just because you'll get a better result. Consequentialism, as the name suggests, focuses our attention on consequences. Outcomes, effects, impacts matter. We not only want to do the right thing, we want to have a positive, beneficial impact in doing it, at least when we can. Now, for hardcore consequentialists, good and bad are synonymous with right and wrong. The right thing to do is the thing that gets you the best result. The wrong thing to do is the thing that gets you a less good result. Good and bad, right and wrong on consequentialist views, sometimes called utilitarianism, are construed in terms of flourishing and suffering, broadly speaking. The right action is the one that either promotes the most flourishing for the most people or minimizes suffering both in scope, the number of people, and intensity, severity, how bad it is. Right and wrong are simply a math equation. Figure out what makes the best sense to help people flourish or minimize suffering. That's the right answer to the question of what you should do. Last but not least, and perhaps less obvious, is eudaimonism, sometimes called more commonly virtue ethics. This focuses our attention on character. Who is it that knows what's right or wrong? How is it that we can do the right thing, especially when it's hard? especially when doing the right thing costs you something. It also focuses our attention on the kind of person we become over a lifetime of action. When we think about notorious criminals, serial killers, big-time corporate scandals, when we go back and dig into those stories, we find out things like this. The serial killer doesn't wake up on Tuesday in 2025 and decide to kill 35 people. We go back and we look that they were a bully as a child, perhaps because they were bullied. We find out that they tortured their pets and were cruel to animals. We find out that along the way, they got into lots of fights and, you know, hurt people. So over time, those smaller actions of violence and cruelty made them the kind of person that later in their life could do that kind of heinous crime. Same things with corporate scandals. You look back at the guys from Enron, Ken Lay, and the other guy whose name just went out of my head, you find out, well, when they worked food service and retail as kids, they tipped into the till. When they were junior sales associates, they padded their expense accounts. When they were middle managers, they took advantage of corporate perks for private purposes. And doing those things over a lifetime made them the kinds of person who, when at the top of the corporate heap with access to all of the power and information they had, made them the kind of people that would take that opportunity to defraud the public, their stockholders, and so on and so forth. So virtue ethics pays attention to that kind of behavior and how it shapes and misshapes us over a lifetime. Now, each of these theories has their particular merits. Every has certain strengths. None can be dismissed out of hand, nor is any sufficient unto itself. We're going to want to use all three spotlights, so to speak, to keep our attention on commitments, consequences, and character. That's ethics lesson number two, basic evaluation. Now for ethics lesson three, but let's recap again before we go to relationship and requirement before God and neighbor. As we've said, ethics is description and evaluation of human action, where we first identify the means and ends of an action. Ends, again, are those things that we're trying to get or trying to get away from. And the means are simply how we do this. We said that we can further specify the ends of our action with reference to goodness, not in the moral sense of right, but in the practical sense of desirability. And we said that something can be desirable because it's useful. This gets me that. Coffee gets me caffeine. Caffeine gets me awake. Awake gets me good performance. Running gets me fit. Fit gets me fast. Fast gets me a win at the track meet. Something can be fitting. Prayer is fitting, whether or not God ever answers. And like we saw with the runner, there are many things in our lives that you can't be the thing, you can't have the identity without doing the activity. And last but not least, things are sometimes enjoyable in and of themselves. It's just a pure pleasure to have a nice cup of coffee, whether or not I need the caffeine. With these descriptions in hand, we can proceed to evaluation. And again, we said evaluation using these different moral theories, these different tools, is like shining different spotlights on our commitments, on the consequences of our actions, and about the character of our lives. Now, when we're prayed up and living right and the Holy Spirit is shining on us, doing the right thing gets the right result. That's awesome. That's easy. The trickier bits come when doing what we think is right gets us less optimal results. And then we're in the territory of compromise. How much of a trade-off of my principles am I willing to make to get the outcome that I think is appropriate? We see this obviously and most dramatically in the world of politics. Oh, I got elected. I don't want to vote for this legislation because it has this bit, but I do want to vote for this legislation because it has that bit. What's the trade-off? We also remarked briefly and in passing that Christian ethics is description and evaluation based on some set of biblical and theological commitments, those of some particular community of Christians, maybe Roman Catholics or Protestants, Presbyterians or Methodists, Westminster Presbyterian Church or Eastminster Presbyterian Church, your congregation here in the South Hills, my congregation in the East End. We also signaled that the Christian in Christian ethics really comes into focus, really comes to the fore, really becomes that brightest spotlight when it comes to evaluation. Many, perhaps even most, descriptions that Christians give of human action will keep close company with those given by others, whether adherents of other religions or of no religion at all. Some, as we'll see in coming weeks, however, will differ. If your theological anthropology, that is, what you think a human being is, says that life begins at conception, then the description you will give to the gestating entity in a uterus is baby, child, person. So in some instances, Christian commitments bear even heavily on description, whereas most of the time they come to the fore with evaluation. Cases like that notwithstanding, Christian faith matters most and makes the biggest difference when we get into evaluation. After all, our faith brings with it commitments. Commitments to justice, not merely as procedural fairness, but as some kind of substantive equality. Not merely justice for our neighbors, but love of our neighbors. And for many Christians, justice and love together give us something that we call the preferential option for the poor and the oppressed, widows, orphans, and aliens, the least, the last, and the lost. Likewise, we understand our faith to be decisive not just for what we do, but for who we are. It shapes our character, our very being. It changes the kinds of person we aspire to be, the kind of life we aspire to live. In other words, character and virtue. In antiquity, Christians and pagans alike prized courage. But the paradigmatic case of courage in what Augustine calls the earthly city of the empire was the courage of the warrior. The paradigmatic instance of courage in what Augustine calls the heavenly city was that of the martyr. Warriors and martyrs are both courageous, but that courage motivates rather different actions in the face of danger and even death. Now, under other circumstances and with a slightly different schedule, we could plumb the depths of these different commitments. We could take more time today in this session, or perhaps devote an entire session to canvassing scripture and cataloging all its laws and commands, its norms and values, its rules and commitments. We could survey the several traditions of Christianity and look at their confessions and their catechisms, their doctrines and dictates, their public statements and social teaching. But this would only get us so far. Not terribly far, in fact. Because as we said earlier, Christians disagree about their commitments. Even those commitments that most every Christian everywhere in every time and place holds are contested. So however much we share and however widely we share it doesn't decide in itself what should or should not be done, how we should or should not act and interact. Take just three of the most central and widely shared Christian commitments. Commitments that in some form or fashion hold for nearly every Christian everywhere for all time. First, Jesus is Lord. Christos Kurios, that fundamental confession of Christian faith that gets the whole enterprise going. Well, what does Jesus' lordship amount to? Does it amount to an integration of altar and throne, church and state, such that we pursue some form of theocracy or integralism? Or is the kingdom of God so radically different from the kingdoms of this world that we all should be Christological pacifists, if not messianic anarchists? We opt out of the kingdoms of this world when we opt in to the kingdom of God. Or for most Christians, we live somewhere in between. Some of what our Christian faith obliges us to do means we have to step back and not participate in certain parts of public life. But a lot of what we think our Christian faith compels us to do means we engage. We try to shape our society, not through coercion and making everyone believe like us, but through persuasion. Take justice, another fairly well-established commitment of the Christian faith, and then think about how you apply it to almost any question. For example, does justice demand open borders and unlimited immigration? Or does it require regulated borders and restricted immigration? Christians committed to justice on both sides of this issue will say one or the other for the same reason. So too with love of neighbor. Does love and neighbor mean we should pursue increased law enforcement so as to control crime and disorder? Or does it mean we should pursue decarceration or even prison abolition? So simply canvassing and cataloging Christian commitments doesn't tell us how they should be deployed, what their implications are, or what they make us sign up for in terms of our action and interaction. Even when we agree on these commitments, we often disagree strenuously about how they apply, about what their implications are. So for that reason, I think we'll do better with a more general approach to how theological commitments relate to moral life and specific actions. We see here on the screen a picture of my two boys many, 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 many years ago. When they were young, they grudgingly allow me to use this sort of a picture so long as I promise not to use any recent or present pictures of their teenage years. Even so, we see them here in a rare moment of fraternal concord. Brotherly love rather than brotherly shove. Now, cute as they are, that's not the point. The point is to spell out ethics lesson 3, relationship and requirement. To stand in certain relationships is to stand under particular requirements. In this case, me and my sons. Because I am their father, I am obliged to protect them and provide for them. Because they are my sons, they are required to respect me and to abide my direction. Even so, these requirements are not without limit. I do them no wrong if I don't give them a Ferrari on their 16th birthday. They do me no wrong if they don't bow and scrape every time I come in the room. Justice constrains the requirements on both sides of our relationship. But because my sons and I enjoy the goods created by our relationship, above all else, the relationship itself, we are obliged to maintain the requirements that allow the relationship to flourish and that sustain the goods that it affords us. In this, the goodness of our relationship grounds and bounds the rightness of its requirements. I'll say that again. The goodness of our relationship justifies the rightness of its requirements. So a moment ago, we distinguished between good in a moral sense, or good in a practical sense, and right in a moral sense. And we need to hold that distinction. Here, we're bringing those two things back into relationship, although they remain distinct. If our relationship was not good, its requirements would not be justified. Think tragically of abusive parents. Their children ought not to respect them because the relationship's bad, it's violent. Likewise, no matter how good the relationship is, certain requirements can't be justified, namely those that are not relevant to the goodness of the relationship itself. Put differently, might does not make right, but rather goodness makes for rightness. Just so, it would make no sense for them or for me to say that we valued our relationship, that we loved each other, and then turn around and do and say things that damaged the relationship and impeded the goodness of the relationship and the other goods that it provides us. Just as it would be incoherent for me to say that I love my car, but to leave it out in the rain so it rusts out and looks like that. And if I told you for weeks on end how much I love my car and how great my car was and how much I love my car and turned up with that, you'd think one of two things. Either I don't know what the word love means, or at the very least, I don't know how to translate love as an abstract idea into practical action of care for the kind of thing that a car is. Now, some of you might be thinking this pattern of relationship and requirement is ringing some bells and sounds somewhat familiar. And it should. Because this pattern of relationship and requirement is precisely the pattern of covenant. Yahweh delivers Israel from their bondage in Egypt and then gives them the law on Sinai. Jesus dies for us to deliver us from the power of sin and death and gives the law of love. Insofar as we joyfully receive these blessings as good, we gratefully recognize these obligations as right. Again, this doesn't provide pat answers or simple solutions, but it gives us an additional framework in which we can think about applying principles like love and justice or Christ's lordship. And crucially, it embeds our human relationships in our relationship with God. This pattern of relationship and requirement, what we might call covenantalism, if we wanted to give it a fancy theory name, provides another spotlight for evaluation of human action and specifically for evaluation based on Christian commitments. But it also helps us to highlight the ways in which relationships and their attendant requirements intersect and sometimes conflict. Sometimes our relationship with God will supersede some relationships with our neighbor. Its requirements will override theirs. Think back to the earliest Christians in Roman antiquity. The very confession, Jesus is Lord, conflicted with the political confession that Caesar was Lord. The early Christians thought that they couldn't confess Caesar's lordship because it would just betray Christ's lordship. They couldn't pinch the incense at the altar of the emperor because that would be worshiping idols. So sometimes the relationship to God that we have and its requirements will rule out the requirements of other relationships we have. We'll see this a little bit next week when we look at Christian pacifism among the ways Christians have responded to war and violence. The divine command to love one's enemies on that view precludes taking up arms to protect the innocent. Much more common, however, are conflicting relationships and requirements in the interpersonal, human-to-human sphere. Again, think about my boys. Sometimes, but not every time, my relationship with them and its requirements will override and supersede other relationships and requirements. For example, I may be obliged to help pay for their college, but unless I win the lottery, I am not obliged to pay for any of your children's educations. However, in other settings, this relationship has little bearing. Imagine I was coaching a soccer team on which my boys played. I couldn't put them into the starting lineup just because they're my sons, because the relationship that I and they have to their teammates, to the team, and to soccer itself brings other requirements. Within reason, you only get to play if you earn your spot. Now, when they're real little, everybody gets a turn eventually, But as they grow and the soccer becomes more serious and more competitive, you actually have to be good enough to get on the pitch. And if they came and said, "Dad, how come you never play me? Don't you love me?" The answer would not be to change the starting lineup for this afternoon's match. It would be to have a talk and try to explain how, of course I love you. But part of me loving you in this context is helping you see how you should love and interact with your teammates, and that it would be unfair for me to give you special treatment just because you're my boy. Maybe they'd get it, maybe they wouldn't, but that would be what was right in that particular circumstance. Now, you may recall that some version of this very issue surfaced, around the time of last year's Super Bowl. Now, after the halftime show, I did not think that anyone could have more beef than Kendrick and Drake, but J.D. Vance proved me wrong. A few weeks after the Super Bowl, he went on Fox News. Vance, a relatively recent convert to Roman Catholicism, laid out the Catholic Church's version of relationship and requirement, what's called the Ordo Amoris, the Order of Loves, to defend the Trump administration's immigration and deportation policies. While he was still on the air and in the days and weeks to follow, Jesuit priests, Catholic theologians, and Pope Francis himself all told Mr. Vance that he'd gotten the wrong end of this rather important Catholic doctrine. Even then, Robert Cardinal Prevost, now Pope Leo, told him he got it wrong. Prevost, then Cardinal, said, "No, J.D. Vance, Jesus does not tell us that we should rank our loves." Now, the dynamics in a relationship and requirement in this order of love instead work through what Augustine calls oikeosis, which is a fancy Greek word that has the same root oikos, household, from which we get our modern English word economics. Oikeosis works like this. It begins with that natural drive for self-preservation that we talked about earlier, but it carries with it a moral imperative for wider inclusion that moves us from appropriate self-love to appropriate regard for neighbor through justice. Vance was saying that the order of loves means charity, not in the sense of benevolence to the Salvation Army, but love begins at home, and the further you get from me and mine, the less you're obliged. The way this works is that the order of love is primarily pedagogical. Yes, charity begins at home because that's where you learn how to love. Ideally, and in good circumstances, with good parents or caregivers, and then you move out from there to friends and neighbors, to those who are familiar, and eventually to treating strangers properly. In other words, this pattern of relationship and requirement, this order of love, is centrifugal. It pushes us out. It's not centripetal. It's not pulling our loves in to smaller and smaller circles. In other words, it's not a limit, but it's an imperative, a trajectory outwards. It is a telos that pushes us further and further into more and more remote relationships. And although we begin with those nearest and dearest, we don't end there, which was the case Mr. Vance was making. That's all for now. I know some of you have to get to choir, and I wanted to leave plenty of time here at the end for some conversation. But if you have to go to choir, by all means, please do. Otherwise, questions, observations, confusions about what we've covered so far. Maybe. Maybe.
Such an esoteric subject matter. I mean, ethics is just, why am I sitting here thinking moral relativism came to mind too?
Sure.
But no, I want to applaud you on addressing such a confusing and complex topic. So I never knew a cup of coffee was quite that.
Say again?
I never realized, I love coffee. I never realized, but you could look at it in so many different ways. So
yeah,
you can kind of look at any scenario in life and what the motive is, like the end justifies the means. It's So fascinating topic. Thank you.
So two things to say there. We have to remember, and if I myself forget, please wave your arms and remind me. The learned theology of the academy, what people with fancy educations and degrees like me do, emerges from and should go back to the lived theology of the community. So certain things become maybe somewhat rarefied, sound a little esoteric, but they ultimately are starting with and should return to pressing on the ground realities of lived experience. So we start with things like coffee and then build up to levels of abstraction. The snotty philosopher way of talking about this way of approaching ethics is casuistry, which just means case-based. So when we confront a problem, a confusion, whether it's a confusion looking back on something that's already happened, oh God, what should we think about that? Or a prospective perplexity about, oof, what should we do? We want to look at those cases where we think things are pretty clear, figure out what makes them clear, and then use them to think by analogy to the less clear. So the coffee case is a good one. It's okay to use coffee as a means to an end, because coffee is a thing. Assume for the sake of argument that it is sustainably produced and harvested and justly compensated all the way through the production chain. You can't always assume that with coffee. That's why we have things like fair trade. But assume for the sake of argument, that's all in good order. I'm not doing anything wrong by treating coffee as a means to an end. I am doing something wrong, evil Eric, when I treat a person as a means to an end. So all that this fancy theoretical talk does is give us some tools and techniques to try to pick out those kinds of things. You also asked about moral relativism. Morality is always relative to experience and circumstance. You know, we can think and believe things today that people 100 or 1,000 years ago couldn't possibly think because of their own circumstance. That doesn't mean that they were equally right and we're equally right. It just means that we have to take into account differences in circumstance. Now, when we're working historically, when we're looking back at what people thought in the Middle Ages, the Reformation, whatever, we want to first take them on their own terms. I mean, we won't be doing a whole lot of this in this seminar, but we want to give them a charitable read based, you know, we don't think, and think about this on analogy to science. We don't think people in the 400s were big dummy heads because they thought the world was flat. What else were they going to think given the scientific knowledge that they had? So we want to first look at them charitably in their own circumstance, but then we need to look at them from our own vantage point and be like, yeah, flat earth theory, not so much. And if you still think that today, well then, you know, we have words. So relativism itself is relative. It doesn't go all the way down. Part of what we're trying to do when we think in terms of natural law is looking at material realities that are common across place and time that give us a sort of floor on which to stand and to say, yeah, in this time and place this, in that time and place the other thing, but when you look at what human beings are and how we operate, it doesn't matter about your time and place. This is wrong or that's right. Other questions, comments, observations, any lingering confusions? I've either done a very good job or a very bad job if there are no questions. It's one or the other. I mean, you got 30 seconds going out the door or dropping off at the carpool lane, so you gotta keep it compact. So in the next couple of weeks, we'll look at a handful of specific issues that will hopefully flesh some of these abstractions out, and then we'll pull things together in the fourth week, trying to think generally about Christian engagements in broader public life around contested moral issues, particularly in times like ours. But until then, thanks so much for coming. And we'll see you next time.